politics, the bush, and the future of our regions. You're listening to Weatherboard and Iron with Barnaby Joyce and Matt Canavan.
Well, welcome back to Weatherboard and Iron, a podcast here recorded in Parliament House. I've got Barnaby Joyce with me this evening. How are you going?
Well, I think I'm going to be more exciting than you were last week because I listened to you pretty boring.
Oh, well, thanks, mate. Thank you very much. You come back for seconds, though. We had an episode with George Christian last week. We've got about 2,000 people now subscribed, so make sure you hit subscribe so you can follow us. We've got some pretty interesting conversations coming up.
Yep.
But you've just got me and Barnaby tonight.
Yeah, well, anyway, go back to the system that works. That's what I always think, you know. Why change the ingredients of a sponge cake?
Well, it had a bit of a run. And look, this is just another way of us communicating with people. We write op-eds, you put up things on social media. It's just another way of having a discussion about major topical issues, and there's a few things going around today.
I think that's really important, and, I'm hoping next week I want to talk to Andrew Wilkie about Julian Assange. I know that will freak a few people out, but I think it's a topic that we need to cover, and that just goes to show that this is not just about us, it's about political discussions by politicians in politics unedited.
And I might try and get Joel Fitzgibbon on one of these episodes.
You had a bit of a conversation
with him this morning.
You don't have to worry about getting him on. Just let you know you're here and he'll walk in the door and come on the show with you like or not.
He just crashed
my doorstop. But which was good because I knew that as soon as he arrived at the microphone with the cameras that I and he would be the news of the day, and that gave me the opportunity to get my message out. And that was about, you know, the next step of socialism, of industry by reason of this guilt trip called climate policy.
Exactly. Now, we're going to come back to that. But you did something else today, which is really significant. It didn't, I suppose, capture the attention of the news media, but very, very important this place. You introduced a bill today. Maybe tell people about the process. Like, how do you do that?
Okay. This is really important. To be frank, and I know we'll have a say in this, there are 12 senators per state in Australia, 2 per territory. That is by reason of the Constitution, an equivalent number of senators, even though we don't have equivalent populations in every state. And they are elected as if the state is one electorate. So you might live in the electorate of Page or New England. Well, they think the state of New South Wales is one electorate, and the state of Queensland is one electorate. And they elect 6 per half-cent election or 12 at a double dissolution from that one electorate. And I think that's insane that you would have one state being determined to be one electorate, electing 12 senators from that area. So my view is you should break the states into 6 regions, no region being bigger than 30% of the state, and no urban capital basin being more than one region. Now, what that would allow is a greater capacity for people to have representation in the remoter regional areas, a greater capacity for Indigenous Australians to become senators of our parliament, and also that as our lower house seats, the House of Representatives, get bigger and bigger and bigger, for people still to have a political office and also to have this incredibly unique experience called dealing with constituents.
Yeah, exactly. The old saying goes, what do you call a constituent in a senator's office? And then the answer is lost. But partly, that's because, as it stands, roughly 85% of senators base themselves in capital cities, often in the middle of the CBD, not all, but often in the middle of the CBD. And my own story is one where I've gone out with my family to a regional area. I grew up in Brisbane, really, but south of Brisbane in Logan, in the outer suburbs. But I got involved in the Nationals Party, and I view we should represent regional areas. So eventually moved my family up to Rockhampton to put a Senate office there, the first Senate office for 25 years in Rocky. And it's made a real difference. It makes a difference. Reading the local paper, watching the local news, taking your kids down to their cricket or soccer on the weekends, talking to mums and dads, you pick up about what's going on in town the way you don't if you don't live there.
Yeah, and I think they own you. I think they definitely own you, Matt, as a central Queenslander and representing them. And when I was in the Senate, my office was in St. George. It was the furthest Senate office from the coast in the history of Australia. And I believe that that was a sign to people that you don't have to be in Brisbane to be relevant. I mean, after I'd been there for a while, people wished the office was even further west, maybe at Cunnamulla or maybe just under a tree somewhere so they could get me out of sight. But it's so important.
I remember someone saying to me they tried to talk you out of putting the office at St. George because you wouldn't get any media. There's no media around St. George, so that won't work for you, Barnaby. Didn't quite work out like that.
Well, Lawrence Springborg said they sent me to the Antarctic. They actually did to try and get me out of the media cycle, but then I suggested there was a mining prospects down there.
Well, save that for another episode, but you're absolutely right. Just to explain this problem to people, that 85% of senators based in capital cities, the actual distribution of the Australian population is less concentrated than that.
Yeah.
It's about two-thirds of Australians, 67% or so, live in capital cities. So our Senate, if you like, is a bigger capital city than the rest of the country.
Yeah, well, there's a greater proportion of senators in the capital city than there are lower house members in the capital cities, and they're supposed to represent the demographic intensity, like where the people are. And so we have 11 out of 12 senators in Western Australia live in Perth, 11 out of 12, I think, in South Australia around Adelaide, 11 out of 12, or maybe it's 10 in Victoria now are in Melbourne.
I think 10 out of 12 now in Sarah Anderson.
And you've got 11 out of 12 are in Wollongong and Sydney in New South Wales. It's an absurdity, and we've got to do something about it. And if the senators won't do anything about it, then legislation. We don't need a referendum on this. You can do it by legislation. And under the West Washington system, Westminster for the House of Representatives, Washington, the United States for the Senate, we're supposed to be based on that. And you used to tell me about the creation of pastoral states, you might add to that. But why is it that New York in the United States of America can have two senators doing a very good job, very prominent, high-profile senators, but Adelaide has 11?
Mm. Yeah, well, look, I mean, I think it's very important we're in the context that we have declining trust in our institutions. There's no doubt about that. There's frustration, especially in our country communities, frustration that they don't have control or don't know what's going on down here. The conversation seems so disconnected to their own lives that we do have people actually there representing them. And if you've got a reason, often the Senate's been called into question. A lot of people have called into question, why do we have a Senate? Do we need a Senate? The Labor Party used to want to abolish the Senate. The reason we have it is to correct the concentration of population in the House of Representatives. The reason we created this Westminster system is we don't have lords or peers. We want a House of Review. So let's have a chamber where the distribution of political power is equal across the country, if you like. And what our founding fathers, and they're all blokes, but what our founding fathers decided on was states as that equality across the country. Obviously, with the development of capitals like Brisbane and Perth and Adelaide, You know, it has that distribution doesn't quite work anymore, and we need to reinvest in that, making sure the Senate looks after and does represent those parts of the country. I mean, they don't have the same representation in the House of Reps.
And for Indigenous Australians, I would say you'd have it based, as I said, no area being better than 30% of the state, which would mean areas that are predominantly Indigenous, Aboriginal, would have a great propensity and a great chance to actually not be a voice to Parliament, but a voice in Parliament. So from the Gulf would come down two senators, and I imagine that either or both would be Aboriginal, and this would be, I believe, a great outcome. But anyway, just going back to process.
What's just on that point? There's a whole other debate about a voice to Parliament for Indigenous Australians. I'm not going to go into the weeds of that right now. But this is another way, of doing it within a democratic system.
Yeah,
and actual real power, not just talk, not just people
and,
come down
and
talk about
things.
You
don't need the angst of a referendum, and you don't need the probability or the possibility of the referendum's rejected and all the ramifications that would have. This is really putting the iron to the political parties. If the Labor Party want a greater Indigenous voice in the Parliament, and the Liberals want a greater Indigenous voice in the Parliament, and we want a greater Indigenous voice in the Parliament, well, this is actually a voice in the Parliament with a vote, and I just can't see how you can
give people a senator for Kakadu, or a senator for Cape York, or a senator for the Kimberleys.
All you have to do is draw up the bill, bring it into, I'll put the bill into the Parliament. So if 76 out of 151 say aye, if it was brought forward for debate, then it happens. If it gets through the Senate as well, then it happens. And you can grandfather the current senators out and say, look, you don't have to concern yourself too much. We'll work out some process within the political party to grandfather you out for as long as you want to be here, knowing that the term of most politicians is around about 7 years. So it would quickly evolve into a working mechanism. But you watch, they won't do it. And they'll go on with the charade of, oh, yes, I really want to have an Indigenous voice. But if it really could do it, they won't.
Well, and you and I have spoken about this a lot in the past, and I've expressed support for it. I haven't got my own private senator's bill yet. You're ahead of me a bit on that. You've been had the freedom of a backbencher for a bit longer than I have, so give me time. But I definitely intend to come up with a bill. It might be a little different from yours. I don't know yet, but that's okay. I think we've got to, you know, it's the same thing happens in the US Congress where two different bills come in at different chambers, and they go to committees and try and work something out. I suppose one question, so I'll introduce my bill. One question I've got for you is, some have criticised your bill as being a bit malapportionment is the word they're using, that because the capital city only gets
one region, two senators.
You know, a state like South Australia and Western Australia, for that matter, they're very concentrated in that capital city. Do you think it's going a little bit too skewed the other way?
No, because there's a self-fulfilling prophecy that if you have all the House representatives in one capital city and all the senators in the same capital city, then quite naturally when any issue comes up, guess where the interest is going to be?
Yeah.
In investment in that same geographic area. Now, you take the states. You just mentioned Queensland has Brisbane. New South Wales has Sydney. Victoria has Melbourne. Adelaide has South Australia's Adelaide, and on it goes, because that intensity has brought about the investment of public dollars in a small geographic area because of the political power that small geographic area has. So spread the political power out, and again, you get more investment and population growth in new areas. Now, just to go through where this is, so I bring the bill in, just so people know, and then it goes to a perfunctory process in the parliament, and then it goes to what they call the selection committee, and the selection committee determines whether it comes back to the chamber to be debated. No doubt they'll say that this one can't be debated because they don't want it, and then it gets debated and then a vote happens. Now, if you want to go around that process, you suspend standing orders in such a form as you can bring forward the bill for debate, but of course you have to have the majority to support
an absolute majority for that.
Absolute majority to suspend standing orders. And, of course, that won't happen as well. So today I said, look, I'm not going to suspend standing orders because I think it'd be pyrrhic, but I reserve my right if by some fluke of nature it ever became apparent that we possibly did have the numbers to bring it forward.
Well, if people do support this, what you should do is contact your local member, or if you happen to have a local senator, if you live in a regional part of the country, you probably won't have one, but contact them and say you support this and you think there should be a voice for people in country and rural areas. I often think it's not a coincidence that perhaps the only time in our nation's history we successfully developed country areas of Australia was in and around the Joh era in Queensland. And one of the reasons we did that, or I think it happened, I mean, obviously Joh himself had a vision to do that, but it did. He operated it in a time where there was disproportionate representation from regional Queensland. So regional Queensland had more seats compared to their amount of population than Southeast Queensland or Brisbane really did at that time. Now, that's been removed. The Labor Party called it a gerrymander. But what it did was incentivised any Queensland government, including the Joh government, to invest in regional Queensland. They built an airport in Cairns. They electrified the railways in central Queensland. And they built dams. They built the Gold Coast.
Yeah.
That's right. It was nothing before Joh. And it's basically the only time in history we have built large regional centres away from the capital city.
Okay, I disagree. I'm going to give you another example of incredible regional development.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I know where you're going.
It's called the Australian Capital Territory.
That's true.
Right? Where there was nothing but a sheep paddock, though I suppose it's Southwells and the Camerons or something. Campbells, I think, were the two families.
Campbells,
here.
Yeah.
And now we have, 380,000 people. Mm. And the only reason they're here is because of government policy. So don't tell me that government policy doesn't work unless 40% of the GDP in Canberra is now public service. The rest is private enterprise. Mm.
That's true. That is another example, obviously, a special one. And when we get around to talking about new states In Australia too, we can have some state capitals maybe in regional areas as well. So yeah, that's another topic.
How many senators does the ACT have?
Two.
Magic number there.
Yep, two. Okay. So the same as your number. So look, anyway, there's a discussion to be had there. I think it's something essential that the Nationals Party must take up. We represent regional areas and we want to make sure people have the power in regional areas to have their views reflected here. Now, I want to go and talk about the other issues we started with, net zero emissions. So I actually think there's a little bit of a relationship here between these two issues because, as I said before, people get pretty frustrated that there's this disconnect. So the talk of the town here this week is about what we must do to meet net zero emissions in 30 years' time. When I go back to my area in central Queensland, people aren't on the street grabbing me saying, what are you going to do about our carbon emissions in 30 years' time? They are grabbing me and saying, when are we going to build a bloody dam? When are you going to get a coal-fired power station going?
When are you
going
to reduce my power?
Yeah, when are you going to reduce the power prices? That is what people are focused on. But, you know, as we were discussing, you don't have a lot of people coming down from regional rural areas to give voice to those concerns. But we're worried about this thing that's 30 years' time. I mean, this is ridiculous.
The whole thing is a fallacious argument because it is without a shadow of a doubt that Australia by itself will have zero, forget about zero emissions, it'll have zero effect on the climate. And what we have here, I believe, is this sort of a bulwark for a socialist policy for further divestment of the individual of their private assets. And I premise that on the fact that, and I have to kick our own side here. I remember when Peter Costello got on the television with a smug look on his face talking about the benefits of the vegetation management laws, which is basically the divestment from private landholders of their vegetation rights. And then, of course, we had the EPBC Act, the Environmental Biodiversity and Conservation Act, which Robert Hill brought into place, Senator Robert Hill, and he used to say, I hope the Nats don't wake up to exactly what I'm doing here, which was a further divestment by caveat over people's private rights. And now we've got the IPCC report in Korea saying we have to have a vast reduction in the cattle herd to reduce methane emissions, and guess where the cattle are? In regional areas once more. And they underpin our economy, and it's... You know, we have 28 million head of cattle. They emit around about between 70 and 120 kilograms of methane a year. So let's say 100. So if you've got 28 million head of cattle and 100, that's 2.8 billion, if you might correct my math, 2.8 billion kilograms of methane. And we're going to have all these bureaucrats running around telling us how they're going to sequestrate it. And I'll tell you how they'll do it. They'll say, you should let more trees grow on your place.
That's right.
And more trees.
That's exactly.
And that's a further divestment because then that will be a further caveat as they conclude and bring about the result of their sort of novel trip to placate inner suburban preferences to get them, you know, get green votes predominantly. And who pays the price? The person in the weatherboard and iron, the person in the peripheries, the person in the regional economy. And that's why I get so aggravated about it. And they, you know, and when Joel walks away from that press conference that he crashed, saying no coal miner will lose his job, really, Joel, really? When fugitive emissions don't exist anymore, you've got people from your own party who want them to lose all their jobs. And you know more about that, being a former resources manager.
Yeah, absolutely. But before we go to that, I did want to just focus and explain to people what this net zero means, because you have said it right, that what this is about is really that country areas of the country will cop it in the neck. They're the ones that are going to pay for this policy because it's a net zero target. It will still... What the Labor Party is saying is, look, we still want to allow people to go and have a holiday in Aspen or still drive their SUV. We don't want to stop people doing that because it will be net zero. What they're saying then is they're going to get the net. They're going to net out
the
all those gross emissions.
Has to equal zero.
Yeah. And what they're going to do is require country areas
to pay for their trip.
To pay for that cost by, as you said, planting more trees. It's a big way they do it. Planting more trees around the country, taking up productive farming land that provide jobs in cotton gin, sugar mills. If you don't have enough hectares under sugar production, the mill shuts. It's gone, right? And so if these trees come in and take away that production, it is country areas that will cop it to pay the indulgences, if you like, for others to continue to perform the great sin of emitting carbon dioxide. That is what the net is, and it's very important that people in country areas understand that, and that they're trying to hoodwink people and get this through, that somehow we won't be having an effect on the environment, because what we'll do is we'll totally transform regional areas of country. The other thing this does, and we've seen that, as you said, on our own side sometimes in the last 10 or 15 years, is it completely denies opportunities to new parts of the country. So if you've got, if you happen to be, to live, say, in the Cape or in the Kimberleys, and maybe an Indigenous community, when you're in an area that hasn't been developed, that still has the foliage and vegetation that was there when Captain Cook arrived, you will be absolutely banned from clearing that down, because you will be releasing carbon by doing so, carbon dioxide by doing so, and you won't have development opportunities. Now, we already have those restrictions now. That is already a problem for those parts of the country. It will be made worse by this policy.
Well, I was just desperate looking through the phone there. I was reading a report from a gentleman at the Environment Unit at, I think it's part of the Crawford School of Economics, but at ANU. And he was discussing his friends, and I can't remember his last name, but that's irrelevant. But
Frank Jotso.
Frank Jotso. Okay, very good. Okay, yep. Well, yeah, you're way ahead of me. But anyway, but reading it, and just even in his sort of in his diction, he said that we let trees grow back and shrubs. You know, I felt I was in Monty Python. You know, a shrubbery is going to all
save
across
the
your place. Yeah, it's going to save the planet. But it just goes to show they don't really understand exactly what they're about to do. But I know they're going to do it because they've done it before. And the people who cop it in the neck are regional Australians. And of course, because you're few in number, they go, "What's a sector?" Because Albanese has said it's going to affect all sectors, the transport sector, the agricultural sector. So we know it's coming. They've admitted it. And now they're trying to sort of say, "Oh, well, you know, the MLA has said it, you know, that they'll be able to do it." Well, the MLA has actually said if your investment is big enough, you might have a prospect of doing it. But if your investment is big enough, you can put a feedlot on the moon, I suppose. And then they say the NFF support it. No, they don't actually. I mean, look at the latest piece from Tony Marr, and they don't support it. They've got real concerns about it.
Why they don't support it is because the Labor Party has not produced any costings or how it's going to impact the future. You welcomed Labor's announcement today, you know, politically, quite rightly, because it does clarify the difference here, why we're involved here, why we fight, why it's important for people who are interested in politics to get involved, because there's two different visions here. The Labor Party are taking forward a policy which will make our country poorer. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, that's right.
It'll make our country poorer, reduce our wealth, job opportunities.
Just can't work.
Yeah, exactly, right? And that's their vision. That's their policy.
Tell them about the modelling in New Zealand.
We want to get a policy that grows our country and develops it. And, yeah, I was going to come to that, because the Labor Party hasn't produced any costings. So I ran around and had a look on the weekend. So we'll have other countries cost of this. Some other countries have got a net zero target. New Zealand last year legislated a net zero emissions target. And at least they had the guts to do and commission economic modelling by the New Zealand Economic Institute, Research Institute. And it makes for pretty stark reading. Now, I'll say up front, economic modelling is based on a lot of assumptions. I've done it myself. It's only indicative. But in this report, they make very generous assumptions about future technological development. A vaccine arrives in 2030 to make sheep fart less, basically. That's what happens in 2030.
You better make us fart less,
yeah.
Too, because there's
many
from us.
Yeah, it's a bit of
high air. About 0.12 of a kilogram per year.
And they apparently 50% of trucks will be electric powered in 2050 in New Zealand.
Of course.
That's just an assumption. They don't have any necessarily evidence for
that. They'll be loaded with flying pigs.
An assumption that they make in their model, along with a bunch of other stuff. So it's quite generous. They don't actually look at, well, what happens if we don't have those technology options. Even with that technological development, the cost to the New Zealand economy is astounding. So going to net zero by 2050 in 30 years' time will cut the New Zealand economy by somewhere between 10 and 20%, depending on all those assumptions. That if you translate that to Australia, what does that mean, 10 or 20%? If you translate that to Australia, you're looking at a $200 to $400 billion hit to the economy. At a wages level, wages go down by 10 to 30% in New Zealand.
We're a $1.6 trillion economy.
Yeah, well, two trillion now.
$2 trillion.
So that's, yeah,
$400 billion.
And then on a wages front, you're looking at a $7,000 to potentially $25,000 a year hit to Australian wages if you convert that, if you have the same thing. Now, that's the New Zealand economy, which doesn't have the same carbon intensity as ours, which doesn't have a large coal and gas industry that supplies the world with cheap and affordable energy. The impact here would almost certainly be bigger, and that's why the Labor Party won't cost it, because it will absolutely show
what they say about it is they've got to bang on about something in Balmain, and this is how they politically do it. And what they've done in this mad desire to chase the virtues of Balmain and Annandale and Paddington and, I don't know, give me a suburb, inner suburb of Brisbane.
Paddington.
Paddington seems to be everywhere. But, and St Kilda. They've actually completely divorced themselves from the constituency that brought the Labor Party about. That is labourers. And labourers don't exist in their view anymore. And we've seen the first signs that after so much patience by labourers, they're now actually giving up on the Labor Party. And we saw that in the Hunter Valley. We saw that in central Queensland. And I don't know. I don't know how this works. I really sort of ponder it as to whether there will be a sort of another DLP schism in the Labor Party and they'll form another political party, because these two groups are diametrically opposed and they can't exist under the same banner.
Yeah, and look, I was thinking the other day, basically.
Yeah, where did that come from?
I don't know, mate. It's hardly North Queen. Yeah, maybe been too much listening to American podcasts. But I was thinking the other day that basically any political organisation that names itself after something, it tends to move or is always the opposite of what it's named. So the Democratic Republic of Germany, otherwise known as East Germany, was not democratic.
Democratic Republic of North Korea.
Yeah, that's right. That's not the People's Republic of China, not really a government by the people, and the Australian Labor Party certainly no longer a party that represents labourers, as you said. The change here that we've seen in just the space of a few months does reveal that, in my view, regional people in the coal mining industry got it right last year. I know a whole lot of Labor people since the election have been castigating me, saying, oh, we went around and lied to the people of Central Queensland. The Labor Party really weren't going to shut down the coal mining industry, despite the fact they're having a policy. They had a policy at the time.
They were
going
to do it.
They had a policy of the Just Transition Authority, which was literally going to help put people out of work and give them some kind of transition payment, a just transition payment,
but
apparently.
Transition payments. Yeah.
It was going to be just.
Yeah, it's called the dole, you know. And what you're doing is you're putting on people on $280 a week. It used to be on $140,000 a year. And that's why if you go through Muswellbrook and Cessnock, you know, Joel Fitzgibbon had swings of 20% against him in the big booths in Cessnock. And it's not surprising, because their transition is unemployment, and it's the dole, and people who have got a nice, you know, I don't know what, they got a bloody SUV, or they got a, you know, nice house, and their, you know, kids are at the local school. They do not want to go on the dole, and and it's not just them. It's the shop owners who know when there's a mine shutdown that they get no business. And yeah, these people, they're not dopey, and their patience has run out.
People work you out pretty quickly, and whatever Joel is saying now, or the Labor Party is saying since the election, or however many times Anthony Albanese comes up and visits Central Queensland and says we support coal, you know, we want to support it.
Just don't tell
anyone. They know they're not really with you, right? Yeah. It is all a facade right now to try and hide the fact that. They are so tied in now to needing green preferences, green votes. They will always, push come to shove, when the pressure comes on, sell jobs out in regional Australia. Yeah. That's the problem. When you're electing somebody, in my view, when people are going to put someone in parliament, they want to know your policies, and there's a bit of a process in Australia, go through a laundry list of policies. But really what they need to know is they can trust you, right? They can trust you that when the chips are down, you'll go in to fight for them, that you won't be bullied or cowed by whatever the latest trend is down here, and you'll actually fight for them. And once again this week, the Labor Party has shown that they won't fight for you.
And they have got no plan. And this is going to be incredibly dangerous for the Labor Party. Incredibly, I know that, you know, people such as the member for Paterson, Merrill Swanson, they will rightfully be saying, what on earth have you just done to us? And in central Queensland, they might as well park their call flutes, because there's no point rolling them out. It is a dead issue for the Labor Party. And it's bad for our nation. It's really bad for our nation, because, you know, down this vortex of this sort of, philosophical gamble and conceit and a sort of erroneous proposition that you can somehow change the temperature of the globe from a chamber that's approximately 50, or maybe 25 metres from where we're doing this podcast. It is just ludicrous. You know, it is ludicrous to think that there's something, there's some deity in the chamber that has an effect on the climate. There's not. There's 151 so-so people who every now and then walk in and vote on things they probably haven't read.
Well, and the frustrating thing, as you say here, is it's, we've got an opportunity to continue to develop these areas of our country. The idea that our coal mining exports are on the decline or going down is wrong. They've been increasing. There's increasing demand for it. We're getting, there's over 200 coal-fired power stations being built around the country, including by countries like Japan. Not Australia, of course. We're not allowed to do that. That would be sinful. But we're allowed to export it to other countries for them to use our resource to create jobs. Japan, they've committed to so-called net zero. India. They're building 20-odd coal-fired power stations. China's doing over 100.
South Africa.
Indonesia's about 30-odd. They are building them like no tomorrow.
Yeah. We're the smart ones. And we're wise. We're dopey. Dopey Chinese, dopey Japanese.
No, the coal gets cleaned. As it goes overseas,
it becomes morally
washed.
Righteous as it passes over water.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So we have got to take these opportunities, and that's what we're fighting for now. We got to keep up this, and as you say, I think it's a huge own goal from the Labor Party to get behind this. But now we've got to put up the fight for people in regional Australia to keep their job and grow their communities.
Yeah, and make sure we don't get slippage on our side, to be quite frank.
Well, that's true too. So, look, we'll keep up that fight. It'd be easier if we had a lot more regional senators down here.
That'd be good. So you wouldn't make that decision if you thought you were going to lose.
Exactly. So we'll keep up that fight too. And as I said at the start, we've got some interesting conversations up. This week you're going to have a chat to Julian Assange. Andrew Wilkie,
That would be a remarkably good trick.
Yep.
And to all the Americans in the CIA, I'll expect to see you in my office. I'll have a yarn to Andrew Wilkie. This is one of the things where I think those, to be honest, on the right and some on the probably more to the left of the spectrum have in common. We believe in the principle of law, that the sovereignty of law, that a lot of work's gone into the principles of law and they should be abided by. It shouldn't be a judgment on a person's character. That's what the courts are there for. There's a process and the process should be followed. I don't think I'd really like Julian Assange, but I don't want to belittle our judicial process.
Well, I think it's going to be a very interesting discussion, so make sure you subscribe to the podcast so you find out where the next episode is on. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.